The first reading this morning is from Richard Dawkins' 2011 book, The Magic of Reality, which in many ways strikes me as his best book. It's his most accessible book. And this will be read by two voices from our Justice Action Ministry.
People sometimes say, everything happens for a reason. In one sense, this is true. Everything does happen for a reason, which is to say that events have causes. And the cause always comes before the event. Tsunamis happen because of undersea earthquakes. And earthquakes happen because of shifts in the Earth's tectonic plates.
That is the true sense in which everything happens for a reason. The sense in which reason means past cause. But sometimes people use reason in a very different purpose. In a very different sense, to mean something like purpose. They will say something like, the tsunami was a punishment for our sins, or the reason for the tsunami was to destroy the strip clubs and other sinful places. It is amazing how often people resort to this kind of nonsense.
Maybe it is a hangover from childhood. Child psychologists have shown that very young children, when asked why certain rocks are pointy, reject scientific causes as an explanation and prefer the answer so that animals can scratch themselves when they get itchy. Most children grow out of that kind of explanation for the pointy rocks, but quite a few of adults seem unable to shake off the same kind of explanation when it comes to major misfortunes like earthquakes or good fortunes, such as lucky escapes from earthquakes.
It is true that if you toss a penny 1,000 times, you'd expect approximately 500 heads and 500 tails. But suppose you've tossed the penny 999 times, and it's so far come up heads every time. What would you bet for the last toss? According to the widespread misunderstanding of the law of averages, you should bet on tails because it is tails' turn. And it would be so unfair if it came up heads again. But I would place my bet on heads, and so would you if you were wise. A sequence of 999 heads in a row suggests that someone has tinkered with the penny or with the method.
The second reading is from Julia Vinograd, a poet from Berkeley, California, that I read a couple of weeks ago. This is an excerpt from a longer poem. She has got, kind of like Wisława Szymborska, she's got the capacity to be funny and serious at exactly the same time. It's called Playing the Lottery. The date is 2002. I'm playing the lottery. When I win, I'll be so rich that war will only be a short, obscure word, still in the dictionary, but mainly useful for morning crossword puzzles. I'll be so rich that panels of experts on TV will cut the New York Times into strings of paper dolls because nothing's happening today. I'll be so rich I'll buy hangovers from street drunks, collage them into a modern symphony, and everyone will go once a month in their best clothes because they've gotten bored with feeling good. I'll be so rich, I'll make grade schools teach a special course called No, you won't understand when you grow up. I'll give 100 comfortable rocking chairs to every welfare office so no single mother ever has to stand in line again. I'm playing the lottery. When I win, I'll be so rich that everything will be all right, the way they always promised me when I was a child and scared of the dark. As the music plays, I'm going to put a photograph over there. Two summers ago, while flying to California to visit some friends, my Southwest flight took me first through Phoenix. The first leg of my flight from Columbus to Phoenix was jam-packed, not a single empty seat, as usual in the summer. The second, from Phoenix to Oakland, was also, as the attendant warned us, a totally full flight. I was sitting by the window, and a man came and sat on the aisle. There was a seat between us. We didn't say anything. I usually am remarkably introverted on planes, and I don't like to talk with people usually. And anyway, we were waiting for someone else to plop down between us, so why talk? Suddenly, the attendant closed the door of the plane. And the one empty seat on the entire plane was between me and the guy on the aisle. We both immediately realized what a stroke of good fortune this was, with all the extra room, and we turned toward each other, and we both smiled, and we high-fived each other. Excellent, we said. We introduced ourselves, and that's why I put the picture over there. That's him. His name was Marco Antonio Hidalgo. I told him my name was Mark, that my closest friends, as well as my grandparents, always called me Marco. He was going north to visit friends. I was going out west to visit friends. We discovered we both like sushi an awful lot. And we did talk all the way up to Oakland. And the flight flashed by like lightning, because when you're talking and engaged, time passes differently. As I exited in Oakland and he was going up more toward Seattle, we promised to keep in touch. And despite all the odds, after all, it was a single two-hour conversation, that's all. We have kept in touch. So this last year at the Phoenix General Assembly, when I was there for a week, we naturally decided to get together for another face-to-face conversation and a drink after he left work. We had a wonderful time and talked for about 3 hours. We talked about our lives, who we were. And one of the things I told him was that I sometimes feel like the luckiest person in the world. So many good things have befallen me in my life. I've come to love the most amazing people I can possibly imagine, starting and finishing with my son, Tony, but so many others. I've enjoyed good, engaging work that has both taken me deep into the human condition and helped me to travel around the world. I've seen things. Marco Antonio then said to me, I understand what you're saying when you use the word lucky, but me, I don't use the word lucky. I don't use the word luck either. I prefer to say fortune and fortunate instead. I hum. I think of them as meaning pretty much the same thing, I suggested, along with the word chance. He answered, oh, I know, I understand that they are often used interchangeably with each other and with the word chance, but the words luck and chance sound mechanistic and cold to me. I associate them with the addictive life of the casinos and the magical thinking associated with lotteries. However, the word fortune is surrounded by other meanings, like abundance, for example, and the word rich. And by rich, he said, I'm not talking about bank accounts. Of course, that's part of it, I suppose. But also the rich world that we live in, a world of rich culture and abundant natural beauty and remarkable resources. Fortunate, to me, suggests the richness of life in friendship and love and joy, in food and delight and pleasure and health and healing, and even in the privilege of grieving. After our conversation, I decided to think about the subtle difference between the words luck, chance, and fortune. And to do so, I decided I would take up the spiritual experiment of not saying the words luck or lucky or chance anymore, but trying to remember to substitute the word fortune instead, as well as its opposite word misfortune when I needed to say that. I decided to see how that felt, what it taught me. And this simple experiment this summer set a lot of my wheels turning in fresh ways. I began remembering my resistance, my immediate resistance when I was a child and I was told, and maybe you were told the same thing, that I should feel lucky because I lived in the best country in the world. I had food, and I was not starving to death with one of those bloated bellies like other children in other countries. I had an allowance to save and to spend, and I was not begging with a bowl on some dusty street in another country like other children my age. I had good schools instead of having to work in the fields in order to survive. And I was in a country with a fair justice system instead of a place where you could be jailed for not telling the police that your parents were still stubbornly attending that underground church. I was told all of these things. But I kept on thinking, but that's not fair. Who are those kids with the begging bowls and bloated bellies and sore feet from working in the fields? Did they do something wrong to deserve such a life? Are they just like me? Why was I so lucky, or as I was told in those days, blessed by God to live in the best country in the world? What kind of a God, I wondered, said, starve to death to some children in a foreign country and eat pizza to me? Consider it perhaps the first significant theological question I ever asked. But I am not exaggerating one bit when I tell you this, because I used to stay up at night thinking about this, me imagining holding a bowl at the end of my own arm on some dusty street in a country with an alphabet I never learned to read, and all the signs. I wanted to try to imagine what it was like, as the proverb has it, to go walking in someone's shoes, or in this case, to go barefoot with no shoes. The poverty I witnessed in my own city of Detroit, near my grandmother's house, verified the things that my eyes were telling me right in front of me about their countries. The vast gulf between poverty and wealth is not something new, although we talk about it a lot now. I experienced it as a kid. The fact that one of our Justice Action Ministry concentrations these next 2 years is poverty alleviation fits with my natural childhood instinct seamlessly. As I grew older, however, and educated myself and was accidentally educated by reality, I learned more about statistics, the kind of thing that Richard Dawkins talks about when he tells us if a penny is tossed 999 times and shows up heads every time, it would be foolish to bet that when it tossed the 1,000th time, it's going to be different. Someone has clearly rigged the penny. It is not, and never has been, the penny's turn to fall heads or tails. Never. There is no natural fairness in reality. There is no such thing as an invisible ectoplasm of luck that you can influence by thinking that it's due you or squishing up your face intently at the gambling table. It's not going to happen. If you do that, you're fooling yourself. Unfortunately, the new and ridiculously huge casino they are building out way on the west side is going to last 1,000 years because people do really believe that luck is due them and that their time has come and it's bound to happen this time. Dawkins makes this very clear. Not only is it a waste of time to say it's bound to happen this time, there's also no good sense in saying everything happens for a reason unless you're talking about cause and effect alone. If you push a car down a hill and the brakes are off on the car will roll down the hill, cause and effect. If the brakes are on, it's not going to do that. If you think it's your turn to suffer misfortune or your turn to be fortunate, you have missed out on the wisdom offered by my late pen pal, Arthur C. Clarke, who talks about statistical theology. Neither wishing or begging or fervent traditional prayer will make nature change its course just because it's inconvenient or painful to you. Statistically, you're on the same bell curve as everybody else, and always have been and always will be. It's reality. You are not being singled out. You never have been. There is no singling out. To think the world is out to get you because you have suffered a great deal of calamity, or conversely, that you are a good person because your luck happens to be remarkable, is simply, in Clark's understanding, false theology. My friend Ange, who I quoted a few weeks ago, teaches similar things at OSU in his economics class. He teaches, and I'm quoting him now, whatever we cannot predict accurately in a mechanical way gets tagged as chance. Ah, see, once again, it's all about what we pretend to control when in fact we don't. What they're all saying, all of these voices, is that nothing is stacked up against us by fate, by nature, by God, the universe. Pick your name for ultimate reality. I don't care. Nothing is stacked for you either. God, fate, chance, or whatever did not put me in the United States and say, live. and to a young girl washed away in a Bangladesh tsunami, die. And as you and I have undoubtedly both observed, you can be rotten to the core and still have lots of good luck. You can be a saint and suffer calamities without ceasing. This is not some new idea I'm talking about either, since the scroll or book of Job in the Hebrew Testament, which wrestles richly with this reality, was written over 2,500 years ago, and an excellent wrestling match it is. When I fly in a plane, like I'm going to do later this week, if I fly 10 times in a row without turbulence, it doesn't mean that turbulence is now due me. Each flight I take is a new beginning. Each flight I take shares an equal capacity for turbulence. No one somewhere owes me turbulence or is keeping track to make sure I have been shaken up fair enough. Chances for turbulence do not build up. Ever. What does build up, however, is my concern for the poor, the same concern rooted in my childhood sense that starving children in some other country is an intolerable and unfair situation. In this election season, when the popular conversation is contrasting the beleaguered middle class with the multi-billionaires, the poor and destitute do not get quite so much airtime. It's between the gajillionaires and the middle class. The middle class does not include the destitute. The terrific poem sections that you heard me read by Julia Vinograd, although clearly written well before this election season, mocks this kind of omission in the conversation. After announcing that she's going to win so much money from the lottery because of her undoubted good luck, she then tells us that she is thereby going to use her gajillions of dollars to eradicate all war, whisk all world calamities away, from the New York Times headlines. No more troubles in Tripoli once she is fabulously wealthy. She's going to buy it all off. She's going to deal with the drunks on the street and the children in her schools. But note carefully. Did you hear it? She's actually not going to do anything for the poor welfare mothers, but offer them rocking chairs so they don't have such an uncomfortable wait standing in line. They're still going to be in line. She eradicates war. She eradicates the shooting of diplomats. But the poor, she only comforts with a cushion on a soothing seat. Vinograd, I think, is brilliantly playing with the whole thoughtful insight lifted up by my Phoenix friend, Marco Antonio. The chance or luck that leads to billions, whether via the market, venture capital successes, inheritance, the law of the lottery itself, is just an empty, cynical, and mechanistic lens for regarding our common world. But the word fortune, with its echo words of rich and abundance, makes me think of the riches of the world as proclaimed by the Eskimo or Inuit people on the top of your orders of celebration, who speak of the riches of the world as intelligence, fearlessness, and love. Such fortunes don't just drop on our head with the spin of a blackjack wheel or jazzy Wall Street speculation. No, they can be cultivated. Fortunes like that can deepen. They can change for the better. and focus not just on personal benefit, but also on those women standing in line with difficult financial straits, whether or not they have rocking chairs to sit on. The fortune Marco Antonio helped me to focus on this summer was not the kind that enables me to fly to Paris for supper and then fly back on the same night, but the fortune that helps me to notice the riches of the world that belong to each one of us, no matter what country we live in, no matter what physique or color we were born with, no matter what kind of house we live in, street we beg on, songs we sing, food we eat, prayers we chant, silence we keep. The riches of the common sky above us all, with and without its storms, the riches of a world that is capable of supplying so many needs of water, food, beauty, and even the possibility of social unity and cohesion. This is the magic of reality, in Dawkins' term, the title of his book, the riches of life, as the Eskimos say. No matter who we are, the joy we have in life is not beginner's luck, but beginner's fortune. The capacity of knowing that we're beginners all the time, not just at the beginning of our life, but right now, me at age 63, beginning again, right now, next minute, I do not know what's going to happen the next minute. And the whole parade of minutes and days before me cannot safely or finally predict what's going to happen next any more than a coin toss or a plane flight sequence can do. Each moment for me and for you is fresh and new. And this is remarkable spiritual beauty as far as I'm concerned. At least I find it far more comforting than the idea of luck, the idea of a capricious God, or the idea of fate, as our ancestors the Romans believed in. We are all, each of us, fortunate to be alive, to be able to grow our capacities to love each other and to be able to support others as they strive to thrive and live out their best lives, no matter their circumstances, none of which we have control over. So yes, it's true what I often hear. The fact that we exist at all, that each of us are mortal, that each of us breathes and that each of us enjoys pleasure and suffers grief, certainly proclaims our unity, our oneness, the oneness of life here on earth. But equal to all of this is the statistical fortune that embraces us all, never blessing us or cursing us because of what we do or do not do, but also not standing in our way as we nurture our capacity to improve the fortunes of others and to dismantle the effects of systems and circumstances, to join together to say, the world belongs to all, to each of us, and no one can be written out of that vision by mere mechanical luck or heartless chance. So, thank you, Marco Antonio, and Richard Dawkins, and Julia Vinogrand, and Arthur Clarke, and Andrzej Baranski, for helping me with my comfortable theological meditation this morning, which has helped me to realize not how lucky I am, but rather how fortunate I am.